On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to today's Conversation Hour. We're publishing phenomenon Hilary McPhee, who used to decide who else's books got published, has now got one of her own. Comedian Dylan Moran joining us as well. He's given up the fags and the booze, and for all the years I've been watching him, he's always made a thing of the fags and the booze. So who's Dylan Moran when he doesn't have those constant companions? My co-host, still grinning from ear to ear from the Richmond Football Club's success, is Gold Logie winner, host of the project on Network 10, also co-host of The Minefield on ABC Radio National, Waleed Ali. Welcome back.
Hey.
Haven't seen you for ages.
It's been stacks of yonks, hasn't it?
And why is that? I mean, you just don't come in anymore. No flowers, no chocolates, nothing.
Sorry, I'm in here weekly.
You're in the building?
Yes.
Yeah, but you don't come and play with us lowly people on local radio.
I don't get invited anymore.
Don't you?
I don't know what I've done.
What's happened?
I assumed that I offended you personally and you just told everybody that that's it. I'm on a blacklist.
Nah.
No, really?
I can absolutely definitively say that is not the case.
Well, in that case, we need further investigation.
Quite but the opposite. I've been saying, hang on, get Waleed to come in and
I'm
play.
Sure.
I saw him in the foyer. I saw him in the car park.
I'm sure that's not true. But it is genuinely exciting to be here in this auspicious week. Is it? Do you think it's auspicious?
How good's Richmond?
Don't do this.
Is Richmond?
All right, fine. You know, I'm more than happy to talk about that.
I thought you might be.
They're amazing. I was at the game and
no kidding.
But
where were you at the game?
I was in the Ponsford stand.
Yes.
In the game. And
in a little glass enclosure?
No.
In a private dining room?
What do you think I am?
I've got a pretty good idea what you
No. Look, firstly, you banned me from coming on your show, and then you spread vicious rumours about me being some corporate type. Anyway, so I was in the Ponsford stand and I was at the game and my initial response to it was GWS were really poor. And then I went and watched the replay, as I've done many times since, and I realised, well, maybe they were, but we were amazing.
You were.
That's the best performance I've ever seen from a Richmond team.
Just about any team ever.
Possibly. It's
absolutely,
right up there.
Totally dominant.
The Collingwood prelim last year where they destroyed us was really impressive. Mm-hmm. And the other one was I was in Adelaide when Port Adelaide dismantled us by 70 points.
Now I go back to when the Brisbane Lions were rampant during the three-peat and totally dominant then. And this was, I mean, you've got so many winners all around the ground.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
I've never seen a Richmond team do that.
Hmm. What's your official role with the Richmond Football Club?
I don't have an official role.
What's your unofficial role with the Richmond Football Club?
Mascot advisor. I used to be on, Richmond used to have a community board.
Yeah.
So I used to be on that. And then that community sort of got subsumed back into the club. So the board took over that. So that board, the board that I was on got dissolved. So I don't have an official role anymore. I used to a little while ago.
How do you cope with being a fanboy?
Analytically. That's the best way to cope, isn't it?
What, you sit down with Dusty and go through exactly, you know, how do you decide which part of your...
Well, look, he was clearly worried about the De Boer tag and he needed a few ideas. Mm-hmm. And I was more than happy to offer them.
At halftime?
Yeah. And just in the huddle, quarter time. No. I don't think I've ever really spoken to Dusty. I know a few of the players personally. So obviously I know Basher. I first met him before he was drafted and so I've followed his career. And then via the club I've met a couple of others. But I actually quite like to keep a distance because I feel like I'm out of place. There have been a few times I've been in the rooms after the game or whatever. And I always feel like I should get out of there.
Yeah.
Like I'm invading someone's space and I shouldn't really be there. Okay. So I like to preserve that kind of distance. So it's not about official roles. It's about being in the stands. Anyway, we've discussed
that. Can you kick?
Yeah.
Can you mark?
Marking was never my strong suit.
Have you played?
I was too short. Yeah.
You played at school?
Yeah.
Wesley thirds or something?
No. By the time I got to Wesley, I was in year 11 by the time I got to Wesley, and it was really all about cricket.
Right.
So I wasn't playing footy then. But I played for the Vermont Eagles, who you might recall around the time I was playing were possibly the strongest club in the country.
Nothing
to do with me, but their seniors.
Everything.
No. Their seniors at that time. Do you remember there was a period, you may not because it was a long time ago, they broken the record for the most number of consecutive wins or something. They got to 50 or 60 consecutive wins. They were just unbeatable. So I was playing in the juniors around the time that the seniors were doing that. And we were in the Essendon zone. So this was back in zoning. And Daisy Williams played for Vermont and then went off and played for Essendon. That was a big deal. And so I was always petrified that I'd end up playing for Essendon if I ever made it, not Richmond.
Did you actually think at some stage you might make it?
Yeah, because when I was in about grade three, I was amazing. By about grade four, everyone had caught up. But I played, you know, you play Little League, right? And so my school was in the Essendon zone. So I went to Vermont Primary. And so I got to play Little League for Essendon against Richmond.
At the MCG at halftime?
No, it was at Waverley.
At Waverley at halftime?
Yeah.
Are there photos? Is there evidence?
There is a photo of me, because what happened was, in that particular game, I happened to be best on ground.
Of course you were.
And so, no, don't be like that. And so what then happened is, I went, they had like a rep carnival, and I was in the Essendon rep team. And well and truly found my place in that rep team. But there is a photo of that rep team somewhere that someone posted on one of the social media accounts recently.
Have you got your arms folded, making your muscles bulge?
Yeah, I probably do, except I would have been 11 or 12. So,
skinny ass.
Yeah, yeah. It was amazing. But I saw sent me that photo recently, and I saw it, and it's incredible how much I look like my son, who's now 12. Anyway, enough about that.
Is this an auspicious week?
For you.
No, it's good.
Are you feeling it like I'm feeling it?
Feeling what? That this is the middle of October and things are moving on?
Why are you doing this?
Because I've got a Friday show, and I think if we talk about John Fane all day, people will get so sick of it.
That
by Friday, they'll be completely over it.
But this isn't about the audience. This is about me now.
Business as usual until Friday.
It's not, though. This is my last ever conversation hour with you.
Yes, it is.
It may even be my last ever conversation hour. Who knows? The new regime comes in,
yep.
Who knows where you stand?
Yep, you don't.
So this is a big moment for me. Yep. And it's a big moment for me because...
Can you remember the first time we got you to come in on the conversation?
2005.
You know that?
Yeah.
How did you know that?
Because I remember the moment well, because I got a call from a producer whose name I still remember. Do you want me to say it? Margaret Lashermy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know what's become of her.
She was filling in for a while, yep.
Yeah, right. So she gave me a call. I think it was in the aftermath of the tsunami, the Boxing Day tsunami.
Mm-hmm. Possibly.
Because I'd written a couple of articles in The Age. One mm-hmm. was in the sports section and yep. one was in the opinion section. And yep. you'd read them.
Yep.
And for some reason thought that that made me worth trying.
No, well, there are a number of things. First of all, we were looking for new voices. Secondly, yeah. we were looking for much greater diversity. And thirdly, we were looking for younger people, and you ticked all those boxes.
I was three times a token.
Yep.
And so I came in and we did that and I had great fun. And I think Greg Craven was on.
Greg Craven?
Because he had a book.
Now the Vice Chancellor of the Catholic University.
Yes, at the time.
Used to previously be the... Crown Council, as it was called, to Jan Wade as the Attorney General of Victoria in the Kennett government.
All right. So I wasn't aware of that, but I knew he was a gun constitutional lawyer, and he wrote mm-hmm. this book called Conversations with the Constitution.
That's right.
I don't know if that was my first one or it was one of my early ones. Mm-hmm. And I remember how much I loved that book because it was the funniest book that had ever been written about the Constitution. And it had a real Blackadder streak. There was something about the way he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one sentence from it, which I read out on air, which was, like socialism and Sydney, literalism has considerable appeal, a surface appeal, but little substance. I thought it was great. That's such a great line. So I remember little moments like that. So I remember 2005, and then there was a period where I was doing it weekly.
There was a period when we had fortnightly, I think we had rotating.
Something like that.
Yeah, we had rotating. We had a team of 10, and we'd rotate them through on a fortnightly basis.
And then you figured out there were more than 10 people in the world that were worth having on. And so,
do you want the truth?
Yeah,
we wanted to change the mix, and it wasn't possible without upsetting people, and I didn't want to upset anyone.
So you upset everyone.
So we extended the gene pool and made the rotations less frequent, whilst not upsetting anyone by saying sorry, we can't have you come in anymore. Whereas if we'd kept it just as 10 people, we would have had to say goodbye to people who I thought were really good.
You could have just been honest to me, mate.
So
you could have just said
we just grew and grew and grew. But you very quickly. Went on to the trajectory that has taken you to such great media heights.
But the point is, this is not about me, it's about you. And the reason I'm very happy to be here, and I know I must have told you this many times, but I don't know if I've ever told the audience this, is that it's your fault that I'm a broadcaster. Without you, it wasn't on my radar. I'd never even clocked it as a thing to do. And I remember it was you that effectively forced your production team to ask if I would fill in for you. And I remember the first time they asked, I thought it was the most ridiculous idea I'd ever heard. And it took a little while, and eventually I had a go. And it was nuts, and I couldn't believe that I'd done it. And then,
have you ever had more fun?
Than that first time, you mean?
Being hosting a, you know, live-to-air prime shift on a major metro market for the ABC, I reckon it's about as much fun as
it
you
is.
Can have.
It's pretty good fun.
Yeah.
I noticed
you didn't agree with me that it's the most fun, which is pretty good.
Most fun I've ever had.
10 here.
I have just seen my team win a second flag.
Okay, right, yeah.
And hey, I have also got to see Liverpool win a Champions League.
If it's true, then, as you just said, I am delighted. And as I've several times said publicly, the idea that a Jew goes on holiday and a Muslim takes his place could only happen at the ABC and only in Melbourne.
I think that's right.
And it's really significant for a whole lot of reasons. That become obvious as soon as you say it.
Yeah, and that wasn't lost on me either.
Yeah.
And you're also a really great sounding board in that period where I was... Look, I had no idea what I was doing.
No, but I had to pay for multiple lunches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, I think you still owe me one.
What?
Yeah. You haven't taken me out for lunch for a long time. I might owe you my career, but you owe me lunch.
We even got halal sausages specially for you and Susan at the barbecue.
Actually, you got a party coming up.
We do.
Thing. Is that going to be halal coded? I assume so. Or kosher or something? Like, what's going on? None of that's been confirmed.
The entire audience are not invited.
Yeah.
No.
That's okay.
So we might just have that conversation.
Oh,
see that red light up there?
That's always on. Don't tell me that means something. I know what that means. I've hosted this show. That red light just means that the mic's on and we're going to air, which is encouraging that we're still going to air. But don't tell me it means something significant.
Dylan Moran joins me, BAFTA and Perrier Award-winning comedian. In fact, I think I read he was the youngest ever winner of the Perrier Award. Star and co-writer of Black Books, and he's here with a new show touring around Australia called Dr. Cosmos. Dylan, welcome back to the conversation hour.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
Lovely to see you. No fags, no booze. Who's Dylan Moran without the props of fags and booze?
I'm a shuddering heap. I'm fine. Yeah, no, they were just props, and very good at distraction. They were, and I find I no longer require them.
But they weren't just props on stage, were they?
No, they were proper life props. They were open your eyes prop, the ones you things you reach for after you open your eyes. Yeah, for a long time, and you know, like all habits, it gets pretty. The grooves get pretty deep, so it can be a little bit of a shocker when. You decide to change the music.
How hard was it to give up? Because cigarettes are
a doozy. You know, whoever packaged those things and thought these will sell were onto something, because trying to extricate yourself from that scene is not easy. I vaped until my eyeballs squeaked, and I am not making that up. It was about 6 weeks, and I think, you know, all these ads you see now for these cool vaping products on the sides of buses or whatever, trying to make it look super stylish the way cigarettes were originally, you know, it's not like that, because I put that thing in my face and I sucked on it, I swear, until my eyeballs squeaked.
How did it literally squeak?
Yeah, literally.
How do they
blink? I would blink and they go,
wow.
And
that's a good party trick.
I thought this is probably not doing me any good either. So 6 weeks of that, but it worked actually. It got me. It did get me off the darts.
So are you saying without the vaping, you're still smoking?
I think I would have been. To be honest, I'm a very weak-willed person. And
but how did it help?
Some people, the vaping becomes addictive.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, isn't it more that they're worried that a generation that wouldn't have taken up smoking,
I think that's the thing, just for the look, you know, because just for people like to have be able to blow clouds out of their face. And that's quite impressive. Like, if you've noticed with somebody vaping walking down a street towards you, I quite like that. You actually don't see them at first. You just see this cloud on top of their shirt collar, and then it parts and you see their face, because there's so much comes out of them.
That's a good party.
I used to love following someone down the street if they were smoking a cigar or a pipe, because you could get the secondhand smoke. You can enjoy it without, hopefully, the downside.
Well, that's not true, though.
Well, as it turns out,
you do
get that. Depends how devoted you are to being in that tailstream, I suppose, you know?
How deeply you're inhaling.
Yeah.
Have you, I assume you've been to London recently.
London town in jolly old England.
Yes.
Yes, I've seen it.
So I was in London about a year ago.
Yeah.
And I was walking around going, what is that smell? I just thought, I've lived my life without much of a sense of smell, and suddenly I had one, and I thought maybe this is just what London smells like. And I couldn't get over it, and I kept asking people, and it turned out it was the vaping.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
What,
yeah.
I had not, the footpaths?
Just everywhere. So it was like, I don't know if it was the particular part of town I was in, but it seemed pretty much everywhere. And this is a big city, right?
Yeah, it's like a hook of pipes. It's sort of it's more just, fragrant.
Yeah, it just sounds like the whole city is
perfume.
Was it
2 in the morning?
No. You know me better than that, John.
I just thought I'd check.
No, it was just... I'm not making this up, am I? This is a thing now.
No, it's around. It's around, yeah.
It's constantly there. It's like it's the signature smell of London.
All right, that's the easy part. That's the fags. What about the booze?
Booze, I just got bored, to be honest with you, because it was, you know, it's. I think booze can be a nice thing if you know what you're doing with it, you know, and you have some wine with dinner or whatever, that kind of thing. It can be really, really enjoyable, and that's fine. But I got bored because I was just doing too much of it, you know. I was just...
Having that insight, though, is the first step to giving up, isn't it? A lot of people never get that insight.
I don't think I got to sort of... I was just getting bored of me and the way it was making me feel. I was, you know, tired and I didn't have enough energy, and I found myself in the same sort of tracks of thought, and I got a little... I found that tedious.
You've positively bounded into the studio today.
Well, you don't even notice that after a while. What I did... What happened, actually, was that... if you live in your head a lot, and I think a lot of people do, I think that is one of the things that makes people smoke and drink a lot. You just tend to, and I'm no advocate for temperance. Okay, I think you should, you know, look after yourself and do what you want to do. But it gets to a point where it's really not that easy to look after yourself if you're doing that all the time. Doing stuff became more complicated. You know, like you have to have a cigarette, you have to know that you can get a drink later on, all that sort of stuff. They become restrictions. On you, and you go, well, why am I wrapping myself up in all this stuff?
You haven't gone vegan or anything, have you?
No, I'm sort of trying that. I mean, there's a few things with veganism that I have problems with. There's that, you know, there's a lot of corruption in the whole vegan world, I'm discovering. And this is summed up by the fact that a perfectly otherwise sane couple of people are quite happy to sit there and eat their dinner and pretend the orange bird shit on their food is cheese.
Is that still vegan?
No, it's whatever they're eating is. I don't know. It's space food. I'm not eating that stuff. Cheese is cheese. That's not cheese. That's powdered impossible.
And vegans won't eat honey, I discovered.
I have a special relationship. I'm on first name terms with several bees, and they give it up for me voluntarily.
Yeah.
So that makes it in,
it's totally okay.
In vegan rules.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why they make so much of it, so that we can steal it. Yeah.
So is the rule then that you have to solicit permission from each individual bee? Do you go, is there a head of a union?
The queen. Yeah, have you got bees?
I wouldn't talk to the queen. She wouldn't talk to me, but there's guys near her.
She's
who
got
know
people.
How it all works. They unload crates out the back.
You've got some drones that
that's
you can
right.
talk to
a couple of drones. I'm in good terms. I've actually got them hooked on booze and cigarettes.
So has it changed your comedy?
I have no idea. I mean, probably, to be honest with you. But I'm try not to be too conscious of all that stuff.
Right.
For being on stage, you know, you really don't want to. You don't want to know what you're up to too much. I'm serious, because if you do, then you start to get forensic about everything and too premeditated and calculated. And I prefer to just. I want to. It's like listening to music. You know, I don't want to know what's going to happen next all the time. I want to do new stuff. So you want to try things out. And if you're too self-conscious about what you're doing, you won't try anything.
But
so
that makes
like,
you
it's
jazz.
Like jazz then. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of, like, I work with a lot of comedians. I've spoken to a lot on air, off air. I find them incredibly calculated usually. Like the level of discussion they'll have about the placement of a full stop. These sorts of things.
Handlebars off me.
Are you
it
just
really
saying
does.
It bores you because it's not interesting to the audience,
no,
or does it actually?
No. Well, it's not interesting to the audience, and on one level, I am really interested. You're absolutely correct about that, because look, I mean, you know, you're a journalist and a writer and a presenter. You put stuff out there. You have to think about what you're presenting to people, because you've got a limited amount of time, and you know, we have to make words work a little harder than we do in our kitchens or, you know, on the street. You want to pack it in, make sure you know the message is clear or the conversation is clear. So yeah, commas and full stops matter a lot, and sequences matter a lot, but
energy matters more.
Absolutely, the thing that matters more than anything when one person is talking to another is human connection. That is the rule, you know. So I get my
In radio terms, people talk about housekeeping and craft skills, But yeah, they never talk about energy. And the main thing you have to do, whether you're on hosting a TV show every night like Waleed does now or doing what I'm doing, you've got to project some energy through the machinery, whether it's this little microphone or a TV
camera. It is, however you're communicating. I mean, I think I have a problem with a lot of the time when you hear, especially politicians, I notice they do this a lot. They come on air and they're quite happy to talk about this very nebulous entity called the public, in quotes, but they don't put it in quotes when they say it. They talk about the public as though there's this lumpen mass of know-nothings out there waiting for their words to enlighten them. And that really, really bothers me. I don't think of a public. I try to think of one person I'm talking to who's at least as intelligent as me and wants me to be clear and, if possible, you know, entertaining in what I'm saying. That's the ideal. I think that's what you're shooting for, you know, that you're talking to somebody who's your equal.
Does that mean, so you're not a fan of, say, watching, you know, comedians in cars getting coffee, a show like that?
I'll look at that stuff, but I'm not interested in, there's a level of shop talk about that stuff. I don't want to hear it.
I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
I look at it and I just go, oh, it's really interesting how they will see something that a mere mortal like me won't see.
I'm very familiar with the thinking behind a lot of comic construction because I do think you can say about people who do that there are a lot of overlaps in their concerns, you know, and in their view. And again, I think you could probably generalize about musicians or writers or whatever it is. There's the same thing, you know. There's going to be points that everybody has to think about. So I know all that, and I've got my own opinion of all that stuff. And then it just becomes comparison. How do you do it? How do you do it? It's interesting up to a point.
To a point, but fundamentally, I mean, the world's in a hell of a mess at the moment, whether you look at Hong Kong or Brexit or Trump or Turkey or wherever you turn. So how political is this new show going to be? It's called Dr. Cosmos.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, this Dr. Cosmos thing was from a snake oil salesman. That's the name. I like the sound of the name because all these populist figures appeared at the same time. We've got Johnson in the UK now. You've got Morrison here. You know, Ireland actually has a pretty liberal, progressive kind of PM, Taoiseach at the moment. The Taoiseach, as they're called in Ireland. But with Trump, Johnson, you know, Erdogan, you know, Putin, all around the world, you get these populist figures around that, which really reminded me of that whole era of these guys, you know, you would see in Westerns rolling up with their wagons, you know, and I just thought of somebody like Dr. Cosmos, hair tonic, restorative, you know, it'll cure all your ills, these snake oil salesmen. That's where the idea came from. So that like a one-stop shop to fix all your ills, you know, because that's basically what these people promise.
You think democracy needs a tonic?
Well, I think that's what these populist guys are promising, you know, that they can cure all your ills. They vote for me, I'll sort you out. It's very gangster, really. And so that's kind of where the title comes from. But I think that, you know, you said, you know, we're in a lot of turmoil politically everywhere. The thing is, though, we are, and we talk about that stuff in places like this, or we talk about it in any forum. But in your kitchen, you know, you're dealing with the minutiae of your life because that's the really big, important stuff. So there's a gulf, I think, between what we all talk about, the very serious global situation, and what we actually really care about, because this stuff is getting so toxic, nobody can deal with it anymore. I know so many people, you know, of our in media, but also just everybody who's just stopped watching news because it's too much.
Well, you go numb to it. But if you've got a snake that needs oiling, you need someone who's a snake oiler. I mean, that's the argument, that the snake needed oiling, so that's why we end up with
this. Is that what snake oil comes from? My understanding with that was that it was an oil extracted from snakes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was going to cure you.
But it's a great way of telling a con artist when they knock on your door, you say, we have no snakes that need oiling here. Now go away. I've done that.
See, I haven't heard that.
I've watched their face and it's hilarious.
Have you just repurposed the meaning of the expression for the sake of getting that gag away? Is that what's happened?
This is a true story.
I don't deny it's a true story.
People who knock on your door and try and con you into signing something at the door.
Yeah.
And I say, look, we have no snakes that need oiling.
Yeah.
Go away.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good lot. You can have that one.
Thank you very much.
But there always has been a theory that a terrible or frightening leader, so let's say a Donald Trump is somewhat like in the lead up to him being elected, that's great for comedy. I wonder, though, does it reach a tipping point where it's no longer great for
comedy? What happens is that, yeah, you're completely right. That tipping point came very early with him.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it happened as soon as you were aware of him, because he's, you know, the absolute exemplar of what's hard to parody, okay? Because
he's more extreme than any parody.
Yeah, and he's never, whatever your joke is, he's never going to be in on it. Mm. He's just, what he is, I think, really, is he's just a boil. He is where all the cess of all our sensitivities, narcissism, and inability to deal with complexity has gone. He's like the little pustule of this.
But we've never been so divided and polarized and in a part. I mean, the conversation we're having now is almost acknowledging that we're so polarized. There are people who are hearing you and agreeing with you, and there are people listening to you going, how biased are they? And there's nothing in between.
But the people who are going, how biased am I, for example, are gravely ill. And the only thing that's going to cure them is a long period of reflection. It's got nothing to do with me, because you talk about polarity and division. But really, when we talk about polarity and division, what we mean is that we're not whole or integrated or, you know, at peace. And this division of, you know, is the human condition. You want something and you're afraid of something. And if you want something, you're going to be more afraid of something because it might stop you getting it. So you feel that those two things are in opposition to one another, and then you have to be false or present a false face to get what you want so the thing you're afraid of doesn't come get you. But you don't have to if you relax and you're honest. Who's going to stop you getting it? The other person? The other person will stop you trying to get it if they're afraid that you're going to try and stop them. But if they relax too, you can probably both get what you want. Everybody just needs to chill out. That's going to be my party's manifesto.
And that's the end of the trade war. There you are. It's sorted.
I like it. Everybody needs to chill out. Is that a premise for a comedy show?
No, it's the new political party.
Yeah.
Everybody gets their own fridge full of beer.
I just can't imagine you going on stage with a message of everyone needs to chill out.
I won't even say it. It's going to be subliminal.
Okay.
Make Dylan Moran great again.
Make yourself great again.
But that's part of what's happened, isn't it? Because we've lost faith in all the institutions and the foundations and the pillars. We've not just been kind of, you know, suckered by the demagogues at the top. And add Duterte in the Philippines and Xi in China and so on. The corruption, the suppression, the censorship, the tyranny. We've never seen anything like this, maybe not since Genghis Khan and Timur the Lame or Tamerlane. I mean, history's never tossed up the same sort of challenges as we face now.
But history's never had a 24-hour news cycle before. Mm. So we have the feeling of being in a rolling boil from the moment you're awake till the moment you fall asleep again. You know, it's that old quote, you know, somebody's joke, I can't remember who it is. The original quote is, you know, history is a nightmare from which we're trying to awake. And then somebody said, history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to get a good night's sleep. Mm. You know? I think a lot of people are in that latter position now.
And yet you can't give up. You can't descend negativity or pessimism. I'm a default optimist, and you just have to look for the glimmers of hope and see how they can be magnified.
Yeah, I mean, optimism and pessimism, you know, they're always around. They're low pressure, high pressure. They're weather cycles. You know, take your pick. You're going to experience one and you're going to experience the other. So I wouldn't get too wound up about it one way or the other. Everybody needs to, sorry to return to the manifesto, but chill out.
Which brings us right back to where we started. Dylan Moran. Yes, you've known him from Black Books and a whole lot of other things. I've been in the audience and have had to seek medical help actually afterwards because it was just almost life-threatening. At the Hamer Hall at the Arts Centre
Melbourne.
Sorry,
you should explain that. That's quite an alarming review.
I was in agony from laughing.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
my ribs were sore.
Is that how you took that?
I caused urinary tract infections everywhere I go.
Welcome to the studio, along with Waleed Ali, my co-host, Dylan Moran, our first guest, Hilary McPhee, AO, writer and editor, former publisher at McPhee Gribble, who's now had to go to another publishing house to get her own story published because she's no longer publishing. It's called Other People's Houses. Hilary McPhee, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Lovely to have you here. Tell us how you got to be working for the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan.
They found me, and it took me a long time to work out how they found me. But it was in 2005, after we, of course, were in Iraq, and I'd been writing a column for The Age, and of course saying we shouldn't be going into Iraq with the Americans. And
the coalition of the willing.
Absolutely. And it was a mild kind of column, but it was political, and it was angry, and it was depressed like we all were. And unbeknown to me, there was in Jordan a woman, a Syrian woman, who was employed by the palace in Jordan to read overnight the international media on the internet. And she apparently read this column of mine. And when the Crown Prince of Jordan was in a very depressed state because he didn't succeed in becoming the king of Jordan, which was what everybody anticipated.
And his 8 years died, or before his brother died.
His brother died, and gave the succession to his son, Prince Hassan's nephew, on his deathbed, virtually. It was a ghastly, ghastly trauma 8 years before I went into Jordan. So I met this very depressed prince whose family wanted him to tell his story. People often recommend books as a form of therapy, really, that will cheer him up and make him feel better about this terrible event that happened. It was indeed terrible. I heard later that they were in lockdown in their palace in the old quarter of Jordan, and the place was buzzed all night, and for weeks they couldn't leave the compound because there might have been an uprising. He was a very popular crown prince. So they found me, the family found me, to get him to tell his story, really to ghost his story. And I had always been very interested in that part of the world. I was long ago wanted to be an archaeologist in the Middle East. And
an archaeologist?
Oh, yes. Being a publisher is like being a poor archaeologist,
well,
really.
You got to Jerash in the end, and I presume Petra too.
You're looking for authors instead of little precious things that you could find. So I had dreams of Pella as a young woman and didn't get there. So when this, I was headhunted in a weird kind of way over several years, and finally I went to Jordan and was interviewed by the palace and interviewed by the prince, and I fell for the project because they showed me Jordan. He showed me his old quarter where he grew up, and I met friends. I met his cardiologist. I saw him performing at the sports centre, and I had a marvellous time.
Your life here in Melbourne had gone into some disarray.
No, it hadn't at that point. My husband, who was Don Watson, was in America writing his American book, and I needed a project because he was away a lot, travelling, doing that, and so I was in London, and my mother had just died. That was the disarray. And I went to London to stay with friends, and then was given a ticket to go to Jordan. And I went to Jordan and was very much seduced by this whole project. So said yes, yes, I'll do it. Came back to Australia to set things in order so I could go back and do it. And my husband decided he wanted to keep moving in America. So off I went to Jordan. Instead, rather shell-shocked, but very happy to be doing this brilliant project.
Had you been to Jordan before?
No, I hadn't been to Jordan before, but they flew me across, first class, all the trappings, to give me a taste of what I would be going into, and I was very attracted to the whole project.
Oh, happy to be attracted to being flown first class to the palace.
Well, that was part of it, I must say, because Australian publishers never travel first class. We were always down the back of the plane, squashed in with everybody else. But they looked after me very well, and I had a fabulous couple of years trying to do this book. The autobiography fell over because the prince suddenly told me that he didn't want to tell any of the stories about his youth. He had a very interesting childhood, of course, in a period in the 1950s in Jordan when it was a very, very tiny place. And he had a marvellous nursemaid. He had all the trappings, a very strong mother and a rather schizophrenic father who ended up being put into an institution in Turkey. It was a very sad story, and there was lots of good autobiographical stuff to tell, but it was clearly not going to happen, and I ended up suggesting a different kind of book to him, which was about the state of the Middle East and Jordan and his role as Crown Prince in it. And
these are royal families that are of relatively recent invention, though, aren't they? They don't go back thousands of years and generations.
Created
no, it's Lawrence
Trans-Jordan
of Arabia stuff,
of course,
isn't it?
Yeah. His great-grandfather was a sheikh, and they were Bedouin sheikhs, and they were extremely sophisticated people.
But the lines on the maps were drawn at the Paris 1919 peace conference on the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I.
But more than that, the royal family in Jordan, I mean, it's Hashemite, right? Mm. The Bani Hashem. So the whole point
very
is
very long
not,
lineage, of course.
But also not Jordanian.
No, I mean,
they have
no.
to be Saudi. This is the
that's the fascinating
it's
thing.
It's the classic symbol of the way the Middle East works. Only yes. a Saudi royal family
yes.
could hold Jordan together. Otherwise, yes. the thing yes. would fall apart.
Yes.
You mean it needs the finance behind
it? No, it needs that tribal independence. You can, once you're from any of the tribes that actually
that's
exist
exactly.
in Jordan, then you have a mass rivalry. It has to be an outsider.
You get more respect as from an outsider, for
or,
an outsider.
Or at least less rivalry.
A unifier.
Yeah. It's like they say about Russia, you know, there's historically, there's a bridge in St. Petersburg where you see Peter holding this on two ends of the bridge of these horses running in every direction. So it's about trying to keep the whole country together. So, you know, the guy who's got the biggest stick is going to do it.
Mm. Arguably, Saudi Arabia is the same sort of story.
Yeah.
Jordan is nothing like Saudi Arabia, though, not as conservative, of course.
I think Jordan is nothing like the Middle East.
No, it's not. It's not. It's absolutely not. It's made up of very many, many different peoples who live there. And the people I met were extremely sophisticated and very interesting people, of course, who looked after me. But I also went into many private houses and went to weddings and did all kinds of things and absolutely loved it. But it was an impossible project, really, to complete in the way that the family wanted it completed. So the prince at one stage said to me, "Don't let them censor me." And I didn't ever ask him who them was. And as it turned out at the end, it was his family who were censoring him because the second generation were very much needing work, I suppose, in the kingdom, needing big jobs, heading up institutions and so on. And they were out of favour because the king was a different branch of the family, obviously. And they were nervous about their father saying too much that was political. So in the end, the family started editing out the political stuff. And I said, "I can't do this unless your father tells me that it needs to be taken out." And he never did. He left it to his very grumpy daughter, who was incredibly rude to me. And I decided I didn't need to be spoken to like that. And off I went.
But you did get your book out.
Yeah. And then I got a book out of it.
Yeah, which is a different story, but and a wonderfully told one too. What's it like, though, someone who spent so many decades at the very pinnacle of publishing in Australia to surrender themselves to a publisher to get their own book out?
To Louise Adler at MUP, she was a very seductive publisher who,
although
when
no
I came back
MUP.
From all this adventuring in the Middle East, I was very broke because I'd spent money doing all kinds of exciting things, travelling a lot. I came back to Australia, the GFC had happened and my superannuation had been hit for a huge hole, had a huge hole in it. And I went to see Louise and she gave me a two-book contract, which I never, as a publisher, recommended to people because you got stuck with the wrong publisher. But in this case, I didn't. Louise looked after me. She wanted me to
write. Did she give you an advance?
She said she gave me an advance. Yes, of course. That's how I survived.
Then you are trapped.
I did. I was. But I did the Burstall Diaries, which we talked about, John. You probably remember some time ago. And then I managed somehow out of all my emails and notebooks and diaries and things to write this book, which took a long time and was very hard to write.
There must have been a lot of writers out there who were delighted to see a publisher in such a position.
Perhaps. But Louise is a fabulous publisher, and I'm delighted she's going on publishing. She's now with Hachette, and that's going to be very exciting for Australia. Yep.
Was there any part of you that looked back at the writers whose dreams you'd shattered along the way and felt a little guilty at some of the decisions you'd made?
No, they're all very lucky to have me. above.
No, but what about the people who are unlucky not to have you?
Who don't? Which ones? Well, anymore?
The ones that would have beseeched you for...
Oh, come on. Did you submit a manuscript and then rejected it?
No, Wally didn't, actually, I don't think. No.
Me?
No, you didn't.
No, not to you.
No.
I'm asking on behalf of people I don't know.
There are plenty of other good publishers now, and all I did was begin a thing that grew and grew and grew, and there's now some...
What's your first book?
This is not my first book, okay. No.
But in this incarnation, the second. But I'm actually... the opposite. I'm astonished at how much rubbish gets published. We get boxes and boxes of stuff sent to us.
Yes.
And some of it is just, I have no idea who they think is going to read it. And I don't understand how it gets past the the filter.
I don't understand either. There is awful stuff, but there have always been poor books published, but I think there are more now, and I tend to blame creative writing classes, I'm afraid, because there have been so many. A lot of universities took refuge in this form of income generating.
Well, and people want to pay to do that stuff.
And they pay to do it, and some of them will never be able to write anything worth publishing, and then they get published somehow because the publisher has signed them up before they've seen the whole book, I think, is often the
That's an industry built on dreams.
Yeah. Yes, of course.
And nothing else, because they're very powerful, deep. Those dreams go very deep.
I mean,
somebody dreams of writing. They dream, a lot of the time people dream of being a writer more than they dream of writing, which is just sitting,
sitting
go back and forth.
Writing is very difficult.
Well, it's all about being able to occupy yourself and not freak out.
Absolutely. Ooh. It's a very scary thing. Yeah. I could only do it if I was listening to music.
Yeah.
And I would sit at my desk I'd put music and I could then work. But if I didn't have music, I would go for a walk and think, there's nothing to say.
Here's an ill thought through question then.
Yep.
If it's true that writing is a product of being able to sit with yourself and with discomfort and with boredom even, is writing destined to become progressively worse in the age of smartphones, where our brains are constantly being trained
I think it's becoming increasingly distilled, shorter and shorter and shorter. We were talking about
the
this outside.
Yeah.
Poetry is getting stronger because people can spend a lot of time working on very fine pages of short things. But I think novels are at risk. I think there are very, very few very fine books.
Swings.
Yes, absolutely.
But, I mean,
and people's vocabularies have collapsed, as I'm sure you know.
Because they're not reading.
They're not reading.
Well, they are reading. It's just
they're reading crap. They're reading crap.
Well, I think it really is about, we were saying out there, it's about time, how we are in time now, because our time has become so atomized, so fragmented. Because of the
Instant responses.
Yeah, the blizzard of stimuli around us.
Yes.
I think stimuli is the key point.
Yeah.
Because I find myself now, it's different, I suppose, if I'm reading off a page, but increasingly I'm not. I'm reading off a screen.
Which is not at all the same thing.
No.
And your comprehension level is at grade 3 standard or whatever. Yeah. But what I find is even something that is not terribly long, I'm a few paragraphs in and I'm kind of like, I'm bored now. Can someone send me a text message, please?
Yeah, you're looking for the end.
I'm looking for something else. I want something else to intervene.
Because you're so used to that. Yeah. That's the rhythm of life
it's
now.
It's the stimulus thing.
It's the dopamine effect. It's the same.
It is.
The same impetus that's used to design poker machines is being used to make the algorithms that drive our mobile phones. It's, and so you become addicted to the buzz, the adrenaline.
But that word is key. Addicted is key, and dopamine is very important. It's because we're in the popcorn chicken era, because that company, I can't remember which of the fast food junk food companies it was, but they perfected this formula where you get the minimal amount of chicken inside the maximal amount of batter, because it contains salt and sugar. You get salt, sugar, and fat, and then the brain receptors shut down, and they go, okay, whatever is happening, this is great. This is a thumbs up from all of us up here. Keep shoveling that stuff into your face. So you sell buckets of this stuff. And that we can't take any kind of, anything that requires any more thought mental chewing.
So the mental exercise of reading is, though, going to become the antidote to this. And in the same way as there are people who are rejecting the fast food bucket of chicken that's got a whole lot of crap on it, there are people who are rejecting the phone, and people are dropping out of social media, they're dropping off Facebook and Twitter, and they're saying, hang on, that is not meeting my emotional and spiritual needs, and I realise it's actually doing me harm.
But it's the rise of wellness as an industry as well is parallel with that.
Yes,
so,
but that's
people
that,
notionally
yes,
have more
yes,
friends, in inverted commas, than ever before, but we've got unprecedented levels of loneliness.
But my question is, this clearly affects readers. Mm. Do you think, as a publisher or a former publisher, it affects writers? Or are the people who are wired to be writers somehow immune from this anyway because of the way they live their lives?
There are some writers that resist this, of course, and read in order to write. But most don't. Most are distilling things into short form work, writing books on their phones, as we know.
Most people don't want to be writers. They want to be famous writers.
Yes, that's
and the reality is about a tenth of a hundredth of a thousandth of 1% of writers become famous writers. And the vanity and the narcissism that makes you think you will be one of those is the lure that keeps people driving that machine.
They should really try something more stable like stand-up.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Or television. Mm. Hillary McPhee's...
Oh, that's going to be around forever, John. Don't worry about that.
Hillary McPhee's book, Other People's Houses, is a memoir. Other People's Houses, just published. Hillary McPhee, thank you. Dylan Morin's show is called Dr. Cosmos. And Walid Ali has been my co-host on The Conversation Hour.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.